family, mm-hmm. everything, mm-hmm. the good, the bad, and the ugly, and they were your family, like mm-hmm. Mary Tyler Moore,
yep.
for 20 years of my life. Okay. So I loved going. My father taught me, and I don't think he taught me, but he loved to get on the school bus. I mean, he'd say, I'm the first person to say hello to somebody, and if I say hello to somebody, that's the worst sin in the world would be if you didn't say hi to dad. And he said, I will set the tone for their day. And he could not get on that school bus fast enough. And I knew so many people in my life that even as a little kid, I look at, oh my God, it's one day.
School bus.
It wasn't work to him.
It was a profession. Right. And he really emphasized that in his mm-hmm. driving. And he used to put himself down and say, I'm just a school bus teacher. That used to make me crazy as I got later grew up. Mm-hmm. Dad, no, you're not just anything. You're a superstar. And I know your dad, Ulysses, was your hero, and mine was too.
And you're listening to Homo Radio on 91.5 FM, WRPI, Troy.
So during your tenure teaching, did you have a favorite position, classroom, a certain setting, age group, etc.?
Well, I never in a million years expected to be teaching junior high. I had taught that in Sunday school prior to becoming a teacher. But then what I wanted was 11th grade. They'd always ask your preference. And what I really aspired to was to becoming a professor, to going to college. And then the job was there. It was in the middle of the summer, and Charlie Zavir, the superintendent of schools at North Colony, called me at my summer job and asked me after they'd interviewed him, do you want the job? And he said he never forgot, and this man had no sense of humor at all. He said, I'll never forget what you said. Don't ask me twice. I'll take it. And I did that spontaneously. I couldn't get there quickly enough. It was in mm-hmm. August, and I thought I was going back to Waterville Eat, and I was going to North Colony. And,
Is that part of it? Was it also because jobs are really hard to get?
Yeah, a pragmatic reality, like so, David. I mean, you're offered a suburban council mm-hmm. school job. Yeah. I mean, you say, thank God, Paul from Congress.
Right.
I got a shot.
You're moving on up.
Yeah.
So to the east side, right?
Yes.
So that's great. Let's talk about SUNY a little bit. So when did you know that you wanted to become a professor? Let's start with that.
Well, my goal always was to become a college professor, but, as time went on and the job situation got... In 1966, when I came to Siena for undergrad, thank God for our finances, I had a full presidential scholarship, which covered everything. And, of course, the finances, the financial need was perfect, and my grades were perfect, so... Yeah. It was there. I actually had five scholarships, but Siena's was the most lucrative because it paid for... everything. I, like the fool that I am, immature, decided I would be a commuter. I could have been at the dorm and had that totally paid for. And I told my nieces that later, you should definitely stay there.
Mm-hmm. College experience.
You need that. You need that. Absolutely need it. But be that as it may, there were no financial problems. And my grandparents bought me a new car because they were able to do it. And that's how I ended up at Siena.
Yeah. How would your students rate you if there was a Rate My Professor back then?
Oh, you mean after my 20 years of secondary ed?
Okay. Yes, when you were 21. A professor.
I would hope that I would be rated highly. I loved being there. I couldn't help but think, people put this respect level on the higher... The secondary level. And in reality, that was a walk in the park. I mean, I'm teaching grad students, English 100, which is long since gone, when you were teaching the basics of the basic to non-liberal arts kids. There were people I had to talk to at that point in my life, and they had discipline problems. I said, the most kids you have are 22, and they're all college kids. How can you have a discipline problem? I mean, go back to Waterville Eat if you have a problem. Yeah. I'll tell you my story. I think they would rate me. I think they'd rate me well. I think they respected me.
How did you earn their respect?
Things that have been mentioned before. I never lie to kids, mm-hmm. and I love telling my stories, and they're all true. Every wacky that can't have happened thing really did.
So you
I mean, the Guinness Book of Records, all that stuff really happened.
So you could carry that through all age groups, essentially, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And you did.
My partner said to me, for God's sake, Ray, don't come across as a seventh grade English teacher when you. to start teaching.
I was hoping
you
would tell that story. Yeah,
because he was adamant. He said, "You're going to go there, and they're going to pick up on it because there's a style. You know how they say you can pick out a kindergarten teacher anywhere. I used to hear that as a kid because they're always having their finger do this. So he thought I was going to do the seventh grade version of that, and I tried to be very academic and professorial and. So they did their first papers and they got back and I was telling Alex, I'm up at the blackboard and I'm writing the three twos there and there and doing all the same things I would have been teaching in seventh grade when their essays came back. It was no different. Mm-hmm. Teaching is universal, no matter, I don't care if you're teaching kindergarten or postgraduate course, the same basics are there. But he was convinced that I was going to give away being, you know, yeah, too young. Acting.
Did you ever have a college student argue with you?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was my first time, my first semester, and I was not yet a professor. I won a teaching fellowship, which thank God again paid for everything. And I had an English 100 on an afternoon at like 4:20, and it was filled with jocks, and I had a kid show up and he was actually talking in the classroom and I'm thinking, well, this is new. And you know, we had a showdown and I told him afterwards, you know, I have no desire to cause any problem in your life, but you're not going to cause it in mine, and if I have to speak to you again, you're out. And and that's not, I don't enjoy those things. I hate that stuff. I hated firing people because of telling student teachers this just isn't for you. It's not what I like to do. I saw people who got off on it.
Yeah.
They like to holler at people in front of others. I never did that. I never embarrassed a kid in class. That's one thing I'll go to my grave saying. I never did.
Yeah. Oh, can you go into that a little bit more about the student teachers? How difficult, I imagine it's very difficult to do that. Somebody, you know, spent all their time and money on their education, and they just don't have it.
There was only one that I ever actually said, you know, it's not happening. I went to heaven and earth to make it happen, but it didn't.
Yeah.
Ironically, someone who later connected with me, I think he knew Ulysses, and he talked to me many years later, and he became a teacher. So, you know, he solved his problems and became a teacher and a great person. I mean, I really liked him. And I said to him, I was so anxious to have this chance. I said, it's Chip. And I said, did you know that I was gay? Because he made me look like Rocky as far as behaviors. And he said that later, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, but I knew you were gay. I said, well, we never told each other. And I know he kept students after school one time, and he said, asked the kids, and confirmed this. He said, is it because I'm gay that you're misbehaving? And the next day, this very staunch and proper math teacher who was only a few years younger than me said, Ray, do you know what your student teacher asked the students that he kept after school last night? And then she had to whisper it. He asked them if they didn't like him because he was gay. And boy, I'm thinking, I'm all over the place. She thinks I'm straight. I can't come out to her. I'm trying to defend Chip. And it was,
wow.
It was, the others I got through it. The biggest problem was, and that was a problem with this particular individual too, when I would be sneaking around, seeing how they're doing and trying not to intrude in the class, and I'd sit down to talk about their class, and I'd say, how did you do today? Oh, I did well. No, you didn't. That was a debacle. We got to start from the beginning. You know, a reality base has to be established.
Yeah.
You know, I was on the other side of the wall. I thought it was coming down. You know, it can't happen. No.
Yeah. So I actually had a coordinating teacher when I was student teaching. At the end of the semester, she told me, she said, I'm really disappointed. I would think someone, you know, from the five-year program would have done much better. And it stuck with me for a little bit, and I didn't want to apply to teaching jobs just based off of what she said. I took it to heart, and luckily a friend of mine really convinced me to apply for a job, and that was my first teaching job. But if that friend didn't step in and be like, oh, that person, you know, don't listen to them. I see potential in you.
Was this a comment that was made at the end of the experience?
Yeah, at the end with my professor in the room. So she was saying that about
that
me
scat
to the professor. The three of us had, you know, a meeting together.
Did she point out what she thought were your shortcomings?
I mean, it was so long ago, but I think she was just, you know, well, you're not as organized as you should be, and
that comes with, you know, practice. That, right, comes exactly with doing.
Well, right? The reason why I asked the question, yeah, was because it would seem to me that if she's saying that at the end, that means she wasn't. What was she doing,
right,
while you, right, were actually?
Right, she wasn't supporting.
She
you
wasn't,
yeah,
right, because that's
right.
If you're not, mm-hmm, organized,
right,
that's something, yeah, that as the master teacher,
right,
I'm pointing out to you as soon as I see it.
Right.
It's like, hey,
yeah,
I'm noticing
at the beginning of the semester,
or right, or a, mm-hmm, lesson, or whatever. I've asked you to do something, and right, I saw, mm-hmm, you go through with it, but it's not. It's messy, right, or whatever.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
You're right on the money with that, because I've seen master teachers that fail miserably. I mean, they're not doing their jobs.
Yeah, and right, then, and then to say it in front of your, yeah, professor.
Right. Yeah, I know. I thought I was going to fail like that. I didn't think I was going to get my degree that day.
It's not good.
So, but I turned out to be an amazing teacher. So,
absolutely. Still there.
Joke's on her. So.
I love that.
So, let's talk about your doctoral program. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Yeah. You do it.
All right. Okay. What did you learn from it? How was that program? What did you have to do? What was the most intensive parts of it?
Well, it's changed, yeah, a lot. I mean, yeah, the requirements. I can't believe how it has. But you had three areas. One was adolescent fiction. One was American literature, 1865 to 1920. And one was literature and psychotherapy, because I was able to play off my master's in clinical psych. I loved the young adult fiction was just my passion. And the other one, I loved American Lit. So I chose things that I really liked, because they told me that was the key. Hmm. You had, at the end, you know, I had 75 books that I had to have for the American Lit. The literature and psychotherapy, I worked closely with another professor who taught literature or psychotherapy, not literature and psychotherapy, and that was, you know, that's how it came down. And you had three exams, two written ones and one that had the highest pressure imaginable, approximately an hour with the three individuals, one for each. And you had to have passed your two written exams, which were, I had no idea. They told me they did this in Ivy League. Those exams, they put you in a room, and there's no time limit. I mean, there were people who stayed there and were there the next morning.
Wow.
You would just stay there as long as you needed to mm-hmm. write those answers. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, yeah, anybody could cheat on this until you were there, and they were so detailed. I mean, I was asked to write a curriculum for an entire year for a course. And I'm thinking, this could take, you could go to a week and teach, you know, together yeah. with a bunch of teachers. And
how long did that take you?
I finished mine in around 4 hours, both of them. Yeah.
And wow. That,
yeah.
That's crazy.
But I'll never forget the day that, of the orals, because the tension is just so, so stressful. And you don't know. Mm. Again, anything is fair game in all those books that you declared that you've read. And then they go out. And they leave like a jury, and they come back in and they said, "Congratulations, Dr. Working." And
wow.
I just wondered if I even I was
so
too shocked
powerful.
To cry.
Yeah.
I was just I wondered if it was real.
Yeah.
I mean, when you've got 5 years of your life just on that part, the money and the effort and all this stuff, it's like, and it all comes down, my written exams are done, and it all is what I say now.
Mm.
And what did I really say? And yeah.
Wow.
My superintendent of school said when I first went for this, he said, "You know, Ray, you'll never." He was a businessman and not an educator. You'll never recoup this. You'll never get this money back. And of course, he was right. You got to really want it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever put together a plan B just in case this didn't come through for you?
No.
Okay.
I just wasn't brought up that way.
Yeah.
Failure was not an option, and okay. I was scared that it would happen, but I never had a plan to back up.
Yeah.
No.
Well, yeah, I mean, you already had your master's and were
right.
teaching
well,
for years.
The worst case scenario, pragmatically, would be I would have
gone
back
to stay where you were.
Yeah,
right?
yeah,
yeah.
should maintain.
Yeah. After getting the sabbatical, which was another issue the first time I got into it, I wanted to go to medical school. And we sat down in 1980, and my partner and I said, you know, you'll be 110 by the time you a doctor, because I couldn't test out of things. They required you to go back to almost high school biology, and it was, I thought you could test out of these things, and now you can. A lot of differences from back then and now. Mm. And my strengths were also in math and science, and I really wanted to become a medical doctor. And I thought, having the master's in clinical psych, the logical step up would be to go into psychiatry and become an MD, but opted not to do it. I always did those things. At the end of the day, I wanted to save the world, and if it would have made me a lot more money if I'd gone the other direction.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. So I just wanted to direct you a little bit more into that question. And what was your big takeaway from your doctorate degree? Like, what's the big picture? What did you learn from it?
I learned an incredible amount about academia. I learned a lot about myself, that I, no goal was unachievable, that I could do that. And I owe a lot of that to my partner, because he kept people away from me when I needed to study. And I'm not feeling that question the way I really want to. I guess, and this sounds so corny, I found out who I really was, and that who was really Ray, and which is not what anybody thinks I am, who doesn't know that other side.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think that you were going to say, it was a self-discovery process.
Yeah.
My next question is, so when you go to school for teaching, you read all these books, read all the theories, listen to several hours of a professor giving a lecture, and you leave college, you get your degree, you think you know everything that you need to know about teaching, and there is a huge disconnect between learning, reading it in books, and actually applying what you learned from college. Was there much that you actually took from your education that you applied? Were you surprised how different it was?
I had an excellent ed course at Siena, but I walked into there like I think 99% of teachers doing believe that I had it down, and I didn't have anything down. I was a newbie out of the box, and I learned it real quickly, especially with the things I tried. So that it's a double-edged sword. I've got such great advice and all profound and academic, and the simple advice is always the best. And that came from the often mentioned Dr. Conley, who's the superintendent of schools at Lindenhurst, and also the head of the ed department at Siena. He said, "Here's to the class. Here's what you do. People are not teachers. Don't like it. Veterans, when you come in and you ask if you can observe them, because it becomes stilted. What you need to do is to snoop at the door." And walk along and listen and hear what they're doing in action.
Mm-hmm.
And Ulysses is raising his hand in affirmation.
Yeah, I did it for years.
Yep. Bingo. You learn the good, the bad, and the ugly, and things to do and not to do. And I did it. I followed that advice. And I also realized how ill-prepared you actually are when you walk into that room.
Yeah.
I did it. The history teacher. Well, and I think to piggyback off of that, in order to be able to do that, you've got to listen to the kids in the building. Who are they saying are the teachers that they respect, that they are learning from?
Yep.
And then you go seek them out. And I was fortunate that the two teachers that the kids were talking about the most, I happen at different points during the day teach across from.
What a break.
I was a new teacher. I didn't have my own classroom. I was a traveler. Or whatever room I was put in, I traveled to the room. And on one occasion, one period, I had this excellent history teacher, and I would give, you know, at some point during the class, I would give kids an assignment to do in class. Now I have 35 kids in the room.
Whoa,
Spanish.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. So just to even go across the hallway to what was daring on my part, and I'm watching this guy.
So you left the 35 kids alone?
Yeah.
It's just across the hallway.
It's just across the hallway.
They'll be fine.
And then the other one was an English teacher who was masterful. He was a brother. And he didn't believe in vocabulary lists. Oh. Hated vocabulary lists and vocabulary books. And he always told the famous story that the department chair, she was giving out the vocabulary books that she wanted the teachers to use, and she got to Brother Jerome and she says, "Oh, you know, I'll get you a teacher's copy at some point." And he said, "If I don't know every single word in this book, I don't deserve to be in the classroom." And so he refused to use that. He made the kids go out and buy a book on prefixes and suffixes, and that's how he taught vocabulary.
Yeah.
And they would read books throughout the year. He says that's the best way to expand your vocabulary is by reading.
Right. Read.
And he didn't care what the kids read. Bring in a magazine, bring in whatever you like, but you have to be reading.
That was exactly what I described, you know, with my Reads for Reading. Mm.
And so those were the two teachers that they saw me, they would see me at the door, they never acknowledged me, even during the time or afterwards, they never said a word. They had a feeling they knew. They knew what was happening, that I was observing them.
Well, that's a real positive. I mean, that they're on board.
And I mean, I was 23, 22, 23.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be a good teacher, and I was like, okay, these are the two that the kids are talking about. These are the two that I'm going to observe.
Great advice. Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Do we have time for two more questions? Or?
Yeah. Joe, I told him we might go over.
All right. Okay, he's on the line.
So, I know you've had a very successful career that has led to several prestigious awards. What were some of the most meaningful ones that you received?
Well, I never expected to go into the Columbia High School Alumni Hall of Fame. And in 2003, when that happened, I was on the board, and the union paid for all the tickets, so they had every union member from here to the moon, and they had 400 and some people I'm trying to think of the place in Troy. It was really outstanding, and my nieces were there, and they said that was the most exciting night we ever had. So that was really one of them. The other, you know, in 2009, I won a community service award from the Pride Center, and in 2018, I was just so thrilled. Within a month, I had gotten a Harvey Milk Lifetime Achievement Award. Ulysses is one of the folks who stood up and gave me the award, said nice words. And within I think it was 10 days, the education director, my brother's then-time boss, gave me the World AIDS Day Award for Education. And that was a real thrill. And also, you know, getting the fellowships from SUNY, the memoriam, and thank God getting those scholarships to go to college, because it wouldn't have happened financially. The presidential was just... Thank God.
No. Real quick, last question. Do you have any advice for a teacher that is struggling? Struggling in the classroom, struggling if they want to...
First year right out of the box?
Let's go with first year teacher.
Year, because I've given this advice. And it comes from bowling, not cars this time. It comes from bowling. When you're in an extremely stressful situation, like the first time bowling on television or the first time stepping in front of your own classroom, give yourself permission to be nervous. The people on TV that failed were bland. You can't go that in bland. And a teacher needs a certain amount of excitement. I've seen people who think they have it all down. That union teacher I mentioned before, he had a mentor. He was in, and he laughs telling this now. He put this lesson together about study hall. And he told them, this is what you have to do in study hall. And his mentor, who really liked him, said, he asked him, how did I do? And he said, that was the most boring thing I've ever sat through. you don't tell somebody in a study hall, this is what you're going to do it. And you've got to bring some excitement to that classroom. Mm. Don't be afraid of it. People think, well, I'm ready to throw up. I think I'm going to pass out. Well, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You ask anybody who's ever bowled well on television, I'll tell you the same thing. I think any athlete, I love sports psychology, which people probably laugh at because it's me, but I think it's life psychology. You need a certain, excitement. Advice to people who are having trouble with teachers is a really profound question. If you're on Facebook, that question is there all the time. People's whole lives have been studied like you said, and they're so excited, and their experience in the classroom is crashing and burning. Again, what Ulysses was saying, go to the veterans, watch them, talk to them. There are people, find the people who are succeeding. Mm-hmm. Look at them, talk to them, and most of them will tell you, you got to stop this. Mm-hmm. This isn't working.
Yeah.
I don't want to upset you, but you're going to have to change this. And transition when you already have a class in motion is going to be tough. You'll see it. This is my observation. The real change will come the next year. You're going to struggle some as you make that transition. You'll make it, but it won't be your best year. Mm-hmm. Your second year, bingo, I got it figured out.
Yeah.
And most of all, don't give up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're that concerned about saving it, dig deep into your heart and your soul. I mean, teaching is the greatest thing in the world. I don't care what anybody says. I heard all of that as being around education. Oh, you get the summer off. That's why you want to be a teacher.
Yeah, no. I hate that.
Do this, do that. And you realize once you get there that if you're a really good teacher, you're going to be working as hard as anybody in any profession, and harder. I mean, especially with English, I corrected more compositions than God. I mean, whoa. And you really want to mark everything on that? People used to give holistic grades. It's a joke. I'll put a grade on. I'll read it. And that was the thing that went around to try and lessen the workload. You got it. You get what you want, what you put into it. I know it sounds corny, but.
Yeah. And your achievements are right there in front of you.
Yes.
I'm sure your success story, you could see just in what you have accomplished in the classroom.
That says a lot. And both of the people from North Colony, from Shaker, gave me, on there, literally, when they were passing away. One wrote me a letter, and another one spoke to me when he had stomach cancer and said things that I certainly didn't deserve, but it made my life complete to know that, you know, something, you really did something. Because even now, I'll look over my shoulder and think, did anybody really follow me? Did I really achieve anything all those years?
So, thank you so much for the opportunity to do this. I just wanted to point out to everyone that we had an hour conversation on my podcast. So you can go to teachershateapples.com or look up Teachers Hate Apples on Spotify and listen to the hour conversation. I believe most of the questions on there are not repeated from today. And again, thank you. I learned a lot about you today.
Well, I'm speechless, which is unusual for me because I just, you're so kind. It means the world. It's validation. You know, you spend your life teaching, and in a blink of an eye, it's gone, and you wonder, did I really do anything? And then when I hear you say these things, it makes me feel that it's all been worthwhile. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Alex.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, we have
Joe on the line.
Joe Lauchs. Hello, Joe, our poli-sci prof.
Hey, how is everybody? Everyone survive another fun-filled February week?
Yes, indeed.
Did you get your sneakers yet?
Hey, strike my $399.
No prices. Overly
that's
priced.
True. I'm sorry about that.
They're just You're golden right. sneakers. Golden sneakers.
I never golden knew sneakers. Wizards wore sneakers.
Joe, did you see? I don't know whether you saw the post, but it was all over the place. How much Richard Simmons would have enjoyed wearing those sneakers?
Back in the day. I'm not at all surprised. Between his sneakers and DeSantis' white dancing boots that he wore when he met the president, the two of them. Footwear is obviously now the new in thing for the right wing fanatics.
It's amazing, Joe. Now, the title of this segment is Paying the Piper. Do you think that Trump is really going to have to come up with these staggering figures, or is Putin going to come out of the woodwork, or someone else?
Well, first of all, you know that he's never going to reach into his own pocket. He's already using his supporters' monies to pay the lawyers and to pay off all of his legal fees. So that part isn't really having much of an effect on him. And are the Russian oligarchs going to come to his aid? They might, unless they fully realize that he doesn't have the chance of the proverbial snowball and you know where of winning this election, in which case they'll drop him immediately, because they're not going to waste their time with him. He doesn't mean anything to them. So the thing is, he's worried. You can see he's worried. He's terrified because he doesn't really have the money. This guy's wearing a cardboard belt if it wasn't for the oligarchs. And he knows that. And he's seen millions and millions of dollars. And remember now, that $384 million that he just got hit with, he's going to have to put that money in escrow. He can't just walk away and say, well, hell, we'll wait and we'll see what happens with the appeals. That money is going to have to be put away. So the bottom line is that he's going to already see hundreds of millions of dollars going out of his pocket. And these are the things that are terrifying him.
The thing that made my mouth drop was when they said what the interest was on a weekly basis on that. My God, does he even have that much money? I mean...
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, with the appeals, it's going to cost him an additional $100 million. So let him appeal all he wants. I just am waiting for the day when we see, when they have to interview him living out of a refrigerator box on the Bowery.
I don't wish Neil on anything, but I will, because what he's done to this country and this world is unbelievable. I mean, earlier in the, and we talked about this before, in the interview with Patrick White, you know, they have a play out called
The Minutes,
and it's not about Trump, but it's about what's happening.
It's Trumpy.
The world, you know. And, of course, it was mentioned again that, you know, this didn't start with him. I mean, if anything, it went with Reagan and back to Nixon and the Southern Strategy. It was on the cover of Time magazine. You know, he realized after 1960 that the real power, real success electorally was, you know, in the South. And that seemed to spawn, you know, ultimately Reagan, and the rest is history. But you can't say that Trump didn't throw the match on the fire. I mean, without him, this would not be here.
Oh, definitely. He accelerated this whole thing to an incredible degree. What he does are things that Nixon or Reagan never would have dreamed of doing. Basically, because both of them still believed in democracy and they actually were Americans. This guy is a Trumpian, and that's all he ever was and all he ever will be, a meist. And all he's interested in is himself.
Mm-hmm.
And based on that whole thing, he has no difficulty whatsoever with how many people he has to step over, or he harms, or actually out and out causes major harm to. As long as he gets what he ultimately wants, which is power and people praising him, which is what his followers do all the time. So this is an incredibly dangerous man. This is an evil man. Mm-hmm. Reagan and Nixon were not necessarily evil. They weren't great people. The things that they did were not good. But they actually had hearts, and they actually did have some compassion for other people. This man has no compassion. He is evil right down to the core.
Well, you know, there's more and more discussion about Woodward and Bernstein. I believe it was Woodward was on the other last night or the night before. They're hearkening back to the Nixonian years. I mean, think of the way that ended. Nixon knew that he was going to jail. He knew that he had to get out of there quickly. He cried that moment on the helicopter. Pat standing beside him, his kids. There was humanity there. There. However evil, he was a crook, but he put a piece of tape on a door. I mean, you compare that to what this one is doing, and it's not in the same world.
Exactly. Nixon opened the doors to China. He actually did put the American people and the country first in a lot of instances. Now, again, granted, he had a lot of psychological issues, and there's no doubt about that. And he did a lot of harm to the presidency, but nothing like this man has done. I mean, this man is not even an American. He's a traitor. This is a guy who praises dictators like Putin and Kim Jong-un. And, I mean, think of it now. Putin just murdered Alexei Navalny, his major critic. Have you heard a peep out of Trump? Of course not. This is the kind of guy who's basically praising that. This is a guy who went out there and said that if you don't pay me, I'm going to tell the Russians they can attack you. This is the kind of person we're dealing with. This is a traitor.
And this isn't the first time. I mean, they rattled off six specific cases just before I left this morning of him. If you disagree with Putin, you're gone. Ultimately, you'll go down in a plane or you'll be shot randomly.
Poison tea.
Yeah.
He had radioactive tea. Killed one guy.
Yeah. He has no problem.
He even tried to poison Navalny, who this was the one he just finally did kill in prison. The thing, Putin is a dictator. He's another guy who will stop at nothing to hold on to power. But one almost expects that out of Russia, because Russia has a history of totalitarianism and tolerating totalitarianism.
Exactly.
I mean, this is unfortunately the history of that country. We're not that kind of people. We don't tolerate that kind of stuff, or we should never tolerate it. Unfortunately, you've got a small group of people, this MAGA coalition, and basically, I love the way Jim Costa explained the MAGA coalition, which was a coalition of the brainless with the spineless. And he's 100% correct.
However this ends, and we're not that far from it, I mean, in a holistic sense. I mean, it's practically tomorrow, this election.
It just seems like forever.
Yeah, and they said it won, of course, as the new year approached. But I wish I, Joe, had your optimism. I know the polls are... We've done the negative side of polls, but I don't see things moving even a little bit. I see this thing where I've just had enough of it. And what's that line I heard, I think, in four different interviews? They're talking to Trump supporters. We already know what's wrong with him. We've all heard it before. It's just another lock on the truck. That's what bothers me. What will wake them up? If he kills a four-year-old in the middle of the Fifth Avenue and then shoots her mother, is that going to do it? No, that's Trump, you know? We don't put him in jail. We don't. I don't know what will stop him.
Well, one of the biggest problems, obviously, is we can't worry about his followers. And I'm not going to say his supporters, but because they're not. They're his followers.
That's true.
It's like trying to convert somebody who is a religious fanatic to a different religion. It's not going to work. These people, that's their religion, Trump. He is their God. So you're not going to ever convert that group of hardcore Trumpian followers, the hardcore MAGA people, basically the brainless ones. You might be able to do something with the spineless ones, because they're basically just afraid of what's going to happen. But these are the elected officials. These are the Congress members who walk out and go on vacation while our ally, the Ukraine, is under invasion. Mm-hmm. And that, but that doesn't even have any bullets to shoot at the Russians with. And these guys go on vacation. So that the president of the Ukraine has to say, you know, this is nice. You guys go on vacation. Do you think the Russian soldiers are going on vacation while you're out? They're continuing mm-hmm. the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys don't care about democracy, because they're... The guy they are about pinning all their hopes on, this evil little yellow man, is out there telling them, don't worry, we can't support it. We've got to be the party of no. We got a great deal on the border. No, we can't vote for that. And then they listen to him. So basically what these Republicans are doing is saying, let's just hand the country over to Trump, and we'll just say no on anything, because we have no reason. We have no alternatives. We have no resolutions to any of these problems. We have nothing to offer the people except no. And that's all they're offering. So let's hope that what we saw happen in Long Island, the Swazi victory, is going to be the template for what happens in November. As long as we listen to what he did and how he won that election, I think we have the potential of not only flipping the House of Representatives, which I think we will do, but I think we've also got a good, we're going to keep the presidency, and we might even be able to keep the Senate if we play that game.
I see things as threefold. Obviously, Trump is, for whatever reasons, his persona, his bizarre narcissism, his mental illness, I mean, you could go on all day. Then you have the cult folks that you've so eloquently described. Then there's a third that I think are the biggest cowards, and if there's a judgment day, we'd be dealt with most severely, and that is the House of Representatives. For them to be, to take that oath, and to be in the House of Representatives and still sell their souls, and the word you have there is dangerous. This man, this isn't like Nixon, as we've said earlier. I mean, Nixon's post-presidency writings tell you how smart he was. You saw his exit. Ford knew that he had to put this pardon out, or Nixon was really going to be in jail, and it was clean. As much as people didn't like it, it was clean. I look back now, and I wonder if he should have. And after pondering it, I still think that it was the only way for Ford, historically, to save this country. What do you think about Ford's pardon at this point, as opposed to before?
No, I definitely think that what he did was in the best interest of the country. It kept the country from being torn apart for another 4 years. Basically, he said, let's end this. Let's stop it right now. Pardon him. He's out of office. He'll never be in office again. He's finished. And so, of course, people were angry, and it did wind up costing Ford the election, obviously. He winds up losing pretty easily to Jimmy Carter, and they wound up losing the House and the Senate, even though they didn't control either one of them. They wound up losing even worse, and they lost a bunch of governorships, etc. I mean, this wound up lasting for two full years, close to 4 years. But the fallout from his pardon. But the bottom line was he did what was in the best interest of the country. And I think looking back, most people would agree with that.
And piggybacking on that, you have the legendary walk of Barry Goldwater across the green grass of the summer to the White House and telling Nixon, I hate to say this, Rich, you don't have, first and foremost, there aren't enough votes to save you in the House or in Congress. And secondly, I have to tell you that even I will not be able to support you anymore. Mm-hmm. When that happened, you have real people. You had whatevers. I can't say it on the radio, I don't think. But anyway, you had, in those individuals, you had character. You had morals. Now, these cowardly people, I never used the word wimp, but I'll use it now, these cowardly wimps that go along with everything, I mean, the whole thing I learned in Glisten, bully, don't go along with bullies. The focus was on bullying. in everything that we did. This is the ultimate bully. Who wins every battle?
Well, the biggest problem is, that the decent people that were once in the Republican Party have all been driven out. And they're seeing the remaining ones who are still there, the ones who are basically kowtowing to everything Trump says, are doing so because the only thing that's important to them is holding on to their power, holding on to their seats. And unfortunately, they've seen that if you go against Trump, you lose the primaries. Don't believe me? Look at Liz Cheney. Look at Kitzinger from Illinois, who basically said, I'm not even going to bother running because I know I'm going to lose a primary. Romney, who basically dropped out of it because he didn't need it, and he knew he was going to have a problem keeping that seat. So the bottom line is these people now are in a party that is completely controlled because there's such a small membership by this fanatical MAGA group. And it all depends on the individual. What's more important to you, the country, or keeping your little seat in Congress and a little bit of power that you have? And unfortunately, for the vast majority of them, it's keeping that seat and keeping that power.
Well, what's happened from 1974, the 73-74, actually Watergate happened in 72. Why, I know what you just said, but what happened with a country that had a realistic base to what's happened now?
Well, there was definitely a reaction to what Nixon had done. And then the pardon angered a lot of people who felt that he really should have been tried and prosecuted. And they wound up turning on the Republican Party. And basically, if you remember, at that point in time, a lot of people were saying, this is the end of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is going to go the way of the Whigs. It's not going to be around anymore. Unfortunately, you have people who at least had some morals, and people were looking at issues, and they were a little more involved. Then right now, people just aren't involved in politics. Social media has destroyed this country and politics in this country. And we all are so worried about likes and our little groups online who parrot everything that we think, and we don't want to think for ourselves at all. We want other people to think for us. So you don't have the same kind of people. I remember in the 74, 76, etc., we would get these tables out and we would talk to people, and you'd hand out literature and you would have conversations. Now try to do that. Everybody's glued to their cell phone.
I hadn't thought of that, but tabling and the type of, when I'm trying to think of the Bobby Kennedy and Keating, Keating was a very beloved man in his Senate position. And you've got Kennedy coming in and an interloper. And I've told you many times the Goldwater stuff was there. That was an example of what was to come in a way. Although it's such a different scenario, and with the death of his brother and him becoming a presidential candidate, people still cared. They still did that tabling. They still gave out those pieces of paper. I don't know what it takes anymore, but I don't think it's an overstatement that technology has destroyed this country. Alex, you're at 32. You've probably seen a devolution in political behavior, just as a kid to now, in terms of what people do versus what they listen to.
I've noticed, I've noticed a big increase in bullying since Trump took office. The kids are, they definitely ramped it up, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the First Lady, Trump's wife at the time, she was doing an anti-bullying platform, I believe. And I just thought that was very ironic. She's like, and look at who her husband is.
Number one bully.
Biggest bully in the United States of America. So if that's our role model for the country, of course kids are going to you know, start picking up on it, especially the older ones that, you know, are informed and see how he acts and whatnot.
Well, I don't, I it's very well said, and I've so many times, 7th grade, 1960, Nixon versus Kennedy, I'm for Nixon. But when Kennedy was elected, I just worshipped that man, and the Peace Corps. And there was a way, you know, you wouldn't go into the military the way I didn't want to, but you'd be doing something right. And I believed in that.
Helping the country.
Yes. I believed everything was possible. And there are probably people in the audience who are laughing out loud, but as a 12-year-old, that's how I felt. Now, Dave, we're, you know, you're younger than me, but I think you're old enough to get some of what I'm feeling. Do you see a difference in the everyday, like the driving habits, they say, are now more aggressive. People aren't as friendly. The tone of the country has changed. Do you see it?
Yes, I do. I think people are much more preoccupied in their, like in driving is a good example. They got something on their mind. They're not concentrating on their driving. Hmm. I don't know. Maybe it's just a general attitude that people take. That they're just not, you know, focused as much as they should be, or once were.
I think, I mean, what the article I read was that there's aggressiveness. I mean, people are aggressive. They're angry. And just that they've calibrated the number of times somebody will hold the door open for somebody. Simple, you know, politenesses. Mm. They aren't as frequent. And I think that's very sad, and I think it feeds into this mess. David, you're one of the most perceptive people I've ever known. I've sat next to you for 18 years on this show. What do you think about that?
I think he's given permission for the substrata of the United States, those people who were bullies or want things their way, they want to tell other people what to do. I think he gives them permission to be more open now, as opposed in the old times, you say, you know, that person's rude, he's bullying, he's, you know, too aggressive, he needs to tone it down. But now it's okay because the orange guy,
yeah,
that's what he does. And everybody loves it.
And Joe, I like the word continuum. On a continuum, when marriage equality happened and the White House was in rainbow lights, I felt that we were really making progress. Now, from what I hear from teachers and former co-workers, we're going backwards. And the number of suicides that interventions that I deal with the Trevor Project would back that up, you know, in objective numbers. There's more bullying, as Alex pointed out. Do you see what we're talking about? Do you agree?
No, very definitely. That's the whole problem. You have a man with the highest office in the nation, the job that most people have always considered like the epitome, the top thing that one could ever achieve, the presidency of the United States. We've always respected that. Mm. We've always cherished that job. And now we look at the guy who had it for 4 years, who was an incompetent, who was a bully, who was a big fan of totalitarianism, of bigotry, of hatred, of racism, and he gave permission to all of this kind of stuff because that's the kind of person he is. And unfortunately, he gave a voice to all those people who had been hiding under their rocks in their little trailer parks and stuff to come out and to voice their own bigotry and hatred and misogyny and all the other evils that are in this world. We had hope with Obama. We had elected the first black president, and my God, the country was looking good. And then that came along, and it completely set things back massively. I mean, we have not had this kind of division in this nation since the days of the Civil War. And it all comes down to the fact that this guy corrupted the presidency and turned it into a position where you could give an okay to people to be evil, to be their worst selves.
Absolutely. I think David nails it with the word permission.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard of this in the state as well. You know, after marriage equality was passed, if you were had a high-level job in the state, you were going to be careful about what you were saying. about someone's mm-hmm. partner, a picture of their partner, any of these offshoots. Now, when I've heard it firsthand, I can't use that word again. It's a word that's gotten crept into the vernacular, but they're pushy. I'll say they're active. They'll talk. They're not specifically told in memos not to talk politics. And my sister will tell you that's all they talk about. And I think for a while, if you valued your state job and you know state jobs, you learn to keep your mouth shut because it just might come back and bite you. Now it's we got permission. The president of the United mm-hmm. States, former and one who wants to come back, is saying this stuff is all right.
Yep. Well, remember, for the longest time, there was actually the ability to have a different opinion than somebody in power. Perfect mm. example. Now, I know we all love and admire log cabin Republicans, and I'm saying that.
Oh, God. You brought them here the first time to this show.
But if you remember, when Bush ran for re-election, they did not support him. Because he was actually, he was opposed to repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and he was looking for a constitutional amendment to bar same-sex marriage. So it was the last moment, the last gasp of having a spine that the log cabin Republicans had, and they said, no, we're not going to support him for re-election. And they made that public. And their membership actually went up. Because people respected that. They respected somebody who would come out and say, no, what you're doing is wrong and I'm not going to stay with you. I'm going to put principle ahead of politics. Unfortunately, that has never happened again in the log cabin Republicans or within the Republican Party, except for a tiny handful of people. Again, people we don't politically we would not agree with, but you have to look at what they did and give them a little bit of credit, like Liz Cheney, like mm-hmm. Romney, mm-hmm. etc. People like that who said, no, I'm putting the country ahead. And each one of these people has had to drop out or were defeated because they showed integrity in the Republican Party. This is what Trump has done to us.
How about Nikki Haley now that she's starting to attack Trump?
Well, she has very little to lose. She's 39 points behind him in her own state. So she's got nothing. It is about time she started to show a little bit of spine and started to take the guy on. But let's remember the one guy, and I have no respect for him because he was so far up a certain part of Trump's anatomy for 4 years. Like I mentioned in the past, the only time you saw his face is if Trump took a laxative. But he attacked Trump. He was one of the few who actually was going out there and saying this guy is not fit to be president. And he was one of the first ones who had to drop out because he got no support whatsoever.
Joe, we're coming to the end, but I had a question at the top of my list that I didn't go to. Do you not see Trump's statement about NATO and failing to support our allies as probably the most outrageous statement made in 100 years in this country?
Oh, it really does honestly close in on treason. These are our allies. These are people who have stuck with us for decades. These are people that we would join together with in most instances after the Second World War.
Yes.
England, Germany, France. Gotcha. These are countries that have been with us, and we have been with them in opposing Russian tyranny and expansion. And we have been once the Soviet Union collapsed and the Iron Curtain fell down, all of these other countries that wound up finally becoming free after all these years of Soviet domination, Hungary, Bulgaria, Albania. I mean, you look at all of these Eastern European countries who immediately came and joined NATO because they knew the tyranny of Russia was real, the threat of Russia was real. Mm-hmm. And this guy is now saying, if you don't pay me, I'm going to tell the Russians they can invade you. This is an outrage. This is outright treason. And this is one of the many reasons why this guy has always proved again and again that he is just not qualified to be president. And I think this is one of the things that may come back, especially among independents, and bite him, because most people have no love for Russian tyranny. And when they hear the guy basically inviting the Russians to invade, and the weak arguments that these spineless Republicans put up, that, well, he's always been a big supporter of other countries paying their fair share. When did we ever worry about money when freedom was involved? What is the price of freedom?
Well, we'll end on that note, because, boy, that's a question that's going to be answered, absolutely. We've been talking to the incomparable Professor Joe Laux, our poli-sci prof. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, guys, and have a good week.
You do the same.
Okay. Bye, Joe.
Bye-bye. Okay, and since we've been talking politics, it's time for our favorite spit of the show here.
Hello, this is Uncle Sam. And though I may be very, very dead, I still listen to 91.5 WRPI Troy. Rock on, America.
The good old days.
Absolutely.
All right.
We are done. That was quite a show.
Okay. Any final words, Ray?
I would just once again like to thank Alex for giving me this high point in my career on Homo Radio, to be interviewed by someone that I go back so far with, and just to look at how far, what you've done in your life, and where you stand now.
It was good.
It's amazing.
It was good.
All right. Thank you.
I lost some sleep last night. I was worried about it.
That's
you said,
the edge.
The nerve.
You want a little edge there.
Give you the edge, exactly.
Yeah, word.
I forgot one question.
Uh-oh.
Go for it.
Do you like apples?
Actually, no. And the funny part is I spent so much of my life in the apple orchard because it was on the back 40 and I could do several things, like first experiences and all my reading and everything back there. But I didn't eat any apples.
I thought you were going to say you were so well liked that people were bringing you apples all the time and you lost the pay for it.
That was a myth to me. I got a lot of gifts and they're on my shelves and everything, but not one of them's an apple.
Really? I've gotten several.
Really? So, well, that's because you're beloved.
I guess. I don't know.
Macintosh. I like Macintosh. Yeah. That's the only kind of apple I like.
Yeah. We had every kind. We brought them to the market.
Yeah.
Nope, just Macintosh. Mm. That's the only one I buy.
We had plenty of those.
I like the Golden Crisp ones.
Had those served.
But I can only have like one. After one, my stomach hurts. So,
Dave, what's your favorite?
Too sweetened.
I like the Macintosh.
Yeah. Any other things you'd like to add, Dave, before we go?
Well, I just want to wish everybody a great week, and I hope you're with us again next Sunday, same time, same station.
There you go.
Absolutely.
How about you, Alex? Anything you want
to add? Thanks again for the opportunity to interview you, Dr. Ray, and please check out my podcast, Teachers Hate Apples. You can go teachershateapples.com or look it up on Spotify.
And a rejoinder on that. You believe me, you will not be disappointed. Alex asks the best questions, and he doesn't let anything go by the wayside.
He does do a great job. I've listened to it myself.
There you go.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Okay, we also like to thank Joe Glue, our news producer, Brian Atkinson, news contributor, Bernie Pulgardi, assistant to the executive producer, Tim Rupert, our archivist, and Randy Stein, our webmaster. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, Ray?
First of all, I really have to thank Ernie, because Ernie Pogardi has so helped me this week. I was very ill the last 3 weeks, and he has been a lifesaver. And if you want to get in touch with me, you may call me at 518-928-0677 or email me at drrayworking@yahoo.com, and that is working spelled W-E-R-K-I-N-G. And again, I love your ideas. I love your thoughts. I love your comments. We're trying to get back on streaming, and hopefully that will change in the very near future.
And if you missed any of our shows because you listen online, you can always go to our archives at homoradio.org. And if you need something to fill the space on Sunday morning, you can play last week's show.
There you go.
The following Sunday.
Just have a week delay. There you go.
All right. Well, that's our show for today, and we will see you all next week.